This is a call from Foothills Medical Center, Renal Transplant Department.
Hi, this is Dr. Anthony Henley calling from FMCU Renal Transplant. And I was hoping to speak with a pharmacist about managing a patient's immunosuppression following a failed kidney graft. I just need to know which of the immunosuppressants we can continue at what doses and targets. My page number is 73625. Thank you.
Immunosuppression in the failed graft? That was new for me. From South Health Campus and Alberta Health Services, this is Farm Talk. I'm your host, Nagar Golbar. I'm a regular civilian doing my PharmD through the U of A, and when I'm not busy with pharmacy, I'm tending to the precursor of drugs, which are known as plants. While on rotation at the dialysis clinic at Foothills Medical Center, I got that dreaded call from, we'll call him, Dr. Henley. Let's recall what Dr. Henley said. He wanted to know what the immune therapy would be for someone with a failed kidney graft. On the surface, it sounds easy. Why would you even need therapy at all if the graft has failed? But once you start thinking about it, you might start to consider things like, well, is the patient getting a new graft? And if so, when? Are they doomed to never get a graft again? What's going to happen to the failed graft that's there? Should we remove it? Can it still cause rejection-like symptoms if we just take away all the drugs that keep the graft going? It sounds like a lot more questions than answers at this point, but I promise we'll work through it. But before even attempting to answer any of these questions, we have to take several steps back and really understand the foundations and big picture of what we're talking about. This step is vital in moving forward with this topic because, spoiler alert, there aren't really any studies that will directly answer this question. So instead of getting a clean answer, we'll be formulating our own based on expert opinion, available evidence, speaking to the pros and cons of immunosuppression therapy, and then looking at what's already being done in practice. So who gets a kidney transplant in the first place? This may seem like a really obvious question, but in a place like Canada, we do have some strategies to avoid transplant, with some of them being chronic disease management, such as regulating somebody's diabetes so it doesn't cause further nephropathy and dialysis. Overall, though, when patients are considered to have end-stage renal disease, a kidney transplant is considered the best treatment, as it offers reduced mortality and is estimated to increase life expectancy by around 10 years. Dialysis seems like a pretty feeble alternative in comparison, as well, if you ask me, that is. Getting a transplant will, of course, cost you, though. Transplantation requires immunosuppression for life, and it uses a multi-agent approach, usually triple therapy. The first agent is a calcium urine inhibitor, like tacrolimus. Secondly, an anti-metabolite like mycophenolate. And thirdly, a corticosteroid, which is usually prednisone. The triple therapy is needed because it offers better overall effect, and thanks to synergy, we can use less of each agent. These drugs, however, are not without risk, which is why we have to be extremely careful with what we use and how much of it. The biggest threats these drugs pose is an increased risk of infection, malignancy, and their typical adverse reaction profile. To look at this risk, let's look at a study published in 2002 and aptly titled, Immunosuppression Should Be Stopped in Patients with Renal Allograft Failure. I'm going to pause for a moment because that title sounds really compelling. It's very in your face. It tells you just stop it. But there's a lot more to this than just stopping. So let's go through it. In this study, Gregor and colleagues do a retrospective review of 197 patients between 1972 and 1994 from the Netherlands. They looked at patients remaining on low-dose immunosuppression versus no immunosuppression following a failed graft. The low-dose group had 1.7 infections per patient per year, whereas the no immunosuppression group had 0.5 infections per patient per year. So in other words, there were 3.4 times more infections in the immunosuppressed arm than the non-immunosuppressed arm. The same study shows us that mortality and cardiovascular disease was also increased in the immunosuppressed patients. There are obviously several limitations to this study, many of them relating to the nature of retrospective reviews in the first place, with which hinge on accurate record keeping. The study had a very small sample size and was restricted to the Netherlands, so applicability to our Canadian population may be limited, and probably most importantly, the patients were primarily on cyclosporine, azathioprine, and prednisone, whereas our regimens today are a bit cleaner using tacrolimus, mycophenolate, and prednisone. So as you see, this isn't a good head-to-head of tacro versus tacro. Also, this study doesn't look at the other side of immunosuppression, which is the benefits of continued therapy. What are those benefits? We'll get to those after a little bit more gloom and doom to really brighten your day. In another larger retrospective cohort study of 8,000 people in New Zealand and Australia, a reduced rate of Kaposi sarcoma and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma was noted in the group that had their immunosuppression withdrawn. In a retrospective analysis of the US RDS database, consisting of more than 4,700 kidney transplant recipients with a failed allograft, the majority of deaths in those patients started on dialysis after graft failure was 36% related to cardiac causes and 17% from infectious causes. And it's thought that immunosuppression played a role in these deaths. In case you don't know what the USRDS is, it's the United States Renal Data System. We do have a tiny bit of Canadian data to go off of as well, from Gill and colleagues. So in Canada, transplant failure patients were more likely to die of infection and less likely to die from cardiovascular disease or malignancy versus our American counterparts and versus the patients who already have a functioning transplant. Okay. Let's pause. We've established that we have a cancer risk, a cardiac risk, and an infectious risk. But I don't think we can truly appreciate just what impact these drugs have on our disease states until we see what the mortality risk is without having immunosuppression driving the problem at all. Approximately 25% of transplant failure patients die within 2 years of initiating dialysis.
What?
In case you didn't recognize her, that was Oprah, equally as flabbergasted as I was when I heard this stat. And I think it's so important that we need to hear it one more time. 1/4 of transplant failure patients die within 2 years of initiating dialysis. In comparison, mortality among age-matched, never-transplanted incident dialysis patients and among deceased donor transplant recipients is about 20% and 6% respectively. This is just a really convoluted way of saying that the baseline risk for death in the failed grafts needing dialysis again or for the first time patient is already really high. So we have to have a really good reason to add to that risk by continuing immunosuppression. But before death by tacro becomes ingrained in your brain, let's review some of the benefits of immunosuppression, because it's not actually all gloom and doom like how I alluded to before. Although it seems like an odd thing to say because we're talking about failed grafts, maintaining immunosuppression can preserve what little remaining residual renal function there is. And by doing so, we can increase life expectancy from 5.3 to 5.8 years. Immunosuppression can also prevent nephrectomy, which is a major surgery we'd like to avoid since that would put the patient at further risk of post-surgical complications, which include cardiac issues and infectious issues. It can also obviously prevent graft rejection, which is usually accompanied by fever, flu-like symptoms, local pain, etc., and just ends up leading to nephrectomy in a lot of cases anyway, and the patient gets to suffer through it as well. But the biggest benefit to continuing immunosuppression is the prevention of allosensitization. Okay, wait a minute, what does that mean? Let's take a step back. What does tacrolimus do? It suppresses the immune system enough such that we don't build antibodies to the graft and therefore prevent rejection. So allosensitization, therefore, refers to when the body is not immunosuppressed and views the graft as a foreign body. One of the first trials to look at combinations of immunosuppression was the Elite Symphony trial, but this trial doesn't quite provide enough for us as it only had 1 year of follow-up, the drug interactions leading to higher serum concentrations of mycophenolate weren't accounted for, and it was unclear if limiting tacrolimus doses would also reduce toxicity while improving long-term outcomes. So we're going to, instead of focusing on the Elite Symphony trial, we will briefly look at a trial done by Weeb and colleagues that specifically looks at HLA class 2 de novo donor-specific antibodies in relation to tacrolimus trough levels. I know that was really wordy and it was probably as difficult to listen to it as it was for me to actually say it, but let's break it down. So these HLA class 2 de novo donor-specific antibodies, which we'll just call them antibodies, are antibodies that have been correlated to both graft rejection and graft loss. This cohort trial looked at 654 patients between 1999 and 2015 over a mean of 87 months to see who was developing these antibodies and how they correlated with their trough tacrolimus levels. They determined that 1, tacro levels have a direct correlation with antibody development, and that 2, the least amount of antibodies were formed somewhere between trough levels of 3 to 7. There are, of course, many limitations to this trial, some key ones being that baseline matching of patients to the graft couldn't be the same for everyone. So your baseline risk of developing antibodies is varied from the start. There is also no mention of other comorbidities or vaccination history, which could have affected outcomes. And mycophenolate levels weren't monitored either, so we're not entirely sure what effect they could have had on the results. Because of this uncertainty around a level of 3 possibly being the most beneficial for those with a really good match, and 7 being the best level for those without a good match, the resulting target in Alberta is approximately 4 to 6, but it is patient specific. To build on the study by Weeb and colleagues, a small but mighty study entitled Immunosuppression with Calcineurin Inhibitors After Renal Transplant Failure Inhibits Allosensitization from March 2020 further looks at how quickly allosensitization occurs after stopping immunosuppression. This study, although very small in that it had 22 participants, actually considered patients who were slated to get a second graft, and for the most part, they were on standard tacro, mycophenolate, and prednisone therapy. It showed us that these de novo antibodies form quickly and peak around 6 months after the calcineurin inhibitor has been stopped, and comments on how immunosuppression should continue to prevent allosensitization. So to briefly pause and recap here, We have seen from our few studies that exist on this topic that there are some positives to continuing immunosuppression, such as avoiding rejection, avoiding nephrectomy, maintaining some residual renal function, which in turn extends life, and maintaining a desensitized state. You might be asking at this point, but why would we want to keep the patient desensitized? I'll get to that in a minute. But if you're thinking of that, keep thinking. And if you weren't thinking about it, now is the time to let that question fester. Some of our reasons for wanting to discontinue therapy include reducing the risk of morbidity and mortality from cardiac infections and cancer-related causes, avoiding side effects, pill burden, and cost. Okay, now let's look at our patient population. Dr. Henley simply said, "What do I do with the immunosuppression for the failed graft?" But he left out a very important detail, and that is the patient in queue to receive another graft? The reason why this is important is because our risk-benefit ratio for using immunosuppression changes in the following three scenarios. Scenario number one, this is the patient who has had a graft failure and will never receive a graft again. This may be due to age, life expectancy, or related to why they lost their graft in the first place. Either way, this is a patient whom we expect to never receive a transplant again. Scenario number two is the patient who has another graft lined up, and this is usually someone who has a living donor. Sometimes the process of redoing the graft can take up to a year, so we categorize scenario number two as the patient who will get a graft in approximately less than 1 year. Scenario number three is the patient who can physically handle getting another graft, but they don't have a living donor, and so they're back on the transplant list with no real timeline as to when they might receive their second chance. So we empirically categorize these patients as those who might receive a graft in greater than 1 year. So armed with our new knowledge and the pros and cons of therapy, we can now make some choices about what to do in these three scenarios. The following recommendation is in keeping with the Alberta Transplant Program and follows suit with what our colleagues in BC and Saskatchewan do as well. For scenario number one, the patient who will never get a graft again, we discontinue the antimetabolite right away, drop the tacrolimus down by 50%, and taper it away over approximately 6 weeks, depending on the patient's clinical status. And as for the prednisone, you begin a really, really slow taper of 1 milligram each month until you achieve a maintenance dose of approximately 2.5 to 5 milligrams, which they will remain on lifelong. The rationale for this is to prevent the need for nephrectomy by giving just enough immunosuppression so that the body doesn't entirely reject the graft. For scenario number two, the patient who has a live donor and they'll receive their second graft in less than a year's time, we push forward full throttle with our triple therapy in an effort to reduce the risk of de novo specific antibodies forming so that the second graft has a better chance of being successful. In this scenario, we put a lot of emphasis on improving the chances of the second graft because more than likely, the second graft is also going to be the last one. Scenario number three, the patient who's on the wait list and will likely take over a year to get a graft. This is our most difficult and most controversial case. It can be really hard to decide what to do here because while we want to give the second graft a fighting chance, we also have to be realistic with our expectations knowing that it'll likely be longer than a year before the patient gets that graft. So this is where science and art meet. And through the very delicate balancing act of risk versus benefit, we come to the conclusion that we can discontinue the antimetabolite, the mycophenolate, right away, but we maintain our tacrolimus, still aiming for that 3 to 5 target, and continue with prednisone, but at no more than 5 milligram per day dosing. And just to pedal back for a moment. Our tacro target could be 3 to 5 or 4 to 6, just depending on the patient's state and what their needs are. But in this scenario, we still try to maintain some degree of desensitization to give the next graft a fighting chance and to avoid nephrectomy, but also to reduce as many side effects as possible. So there you have it. We haven't exactly answered Dr. Henley's question, but we can't because we don't know what scenario his patient falls into. So we're going to page him back on his pager that coincidentally types out renal, if you caught that, and then we'll have to ask him some more questions to see what kind of patient he has. In order to make this podcast, there was a full lit search done on PubMed, Google Scholar. Many studies were reviewed for this, and there was also a lot of discussion with our colleagues in Saskatchewan, BC, and in Alberta to find all of this information. If you need to know anything else, my name is Nagar Golbar. You can catch me between when I'm working and when I'm watering my plants at Golbar, G-O-L, B as in Bravo, A-R, at ualberta.ca. I would love to hear from you. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time on Farm Talk.